This is Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. In the U.S., 1 in 6 people experience hunger, and that number continues to climb each year. But what are people doing locally to combat hunger and make sure that every person in the community has a meal on the table or that no child goes to bed hungry? Here today to talk about this are retired pastor Jeff Franco, who previously worked at Central Lutheran Church of Winona, Pastor Corrine Dennis, she's the Lutheran Campus Ministry pastor in Winona, and Barbie Izquierdo, she's an expert on hunger, and she's a writer and photographer with the organization Witness to Hunger. She's currently a student in Philadelphia. Barbie, I'm wondering if we can start with you. You know, you put your life experience out to everyone. You were one of the subjects of the film A Place at the Table, which is a remarkable documentary that really looks at how hunger impacts people in their daily lives. I'm wondering, just from your perspective, you know, hunger can be so relative, but how do you define hunger? How do you really look at it and really lay it out for people and explain what exactly hunger is?
It's hard to use the word hunger nowadays because technically they do use the watered-down term of food insecure.
Sure.
And what food insecurity is when you don't know where your next meal is coming from. So it doesn't necessarily mean someone who doesn't eat at all, someone who's starving or things of that nature. It just means, you know, the typical family that I'm surrounding myself with and the family that I am and that I have been, that sometimes you're just not too sure what you're going to do or how you're going to make it to the next day. But it's something so much more than that. I think that being labeled food insecure or, you know, suffering from hunger is something that isn't only a physical pain. It's a very, very emotional pain, especially as a parent, because you know that you have children who are looking at you when they need anything and everything, and just knowing that at times you're not able to provide that makes you feel less of a person.
And you have two young children.
Yes, Leilani and Aiden. Layla is 9 and Aiden is 7.
And, I mean, even in the documentary, you know, you talk about how just the impacts it can have on someone emotionally, and you can really see the toll that it's taking on you at different points.
I still deal with it today, especially that since the documentary came out, because I question on whether or not I made the right decision exposing my life and more so exposing the lives of my children, because this is going to be here after I'm gone, and this is something that they're going to have to live with. And they were too young to say, Mommy, don't do this, or Mommy, this is okay. And I don't want them to be the face of the children who are food insecure. I don't want them to go to school and have to worry about maybe someone saw the film and start making fun of them. But the young mother that I was, I just knew that things weren't working. I knew that being on public assistance was very difficult. I knew that trying to better yourself and your life while on public assistance was even more difficult. And being viewed as a statistic made things nearly impossible. And this opportunity was presented to me, and I said, you know, there's one thing that you can do to solve a problem in our eyes. You can either talk about it and let people know that things aren't okay, or you can do something about it. And I think that I spent quite a long time just talking about it and saying, you know, things aren't working and saying that this is what's going on in my life. But I didn't really do anything about it because for plenty of reasons, I thought that my voice didn't matter. I thought that no one wanted to listen. And I knew that people could relate, but I didn't know that they will be there to sort of back me up. So I took a risk, and it was all for the purpose of making a change, and it has changed the lives of my children. It's changed my life, and I think that it's making America a little bit better, just one day at a time. I have people that reach out to me that look for me on Facebook or on Twitter, and they send me these messages of how the film has empowered them and motivated them on wanting to make a difference, and that schools are now using a documentary and having their students write papers on them. And I think that that's remarkable because being in school, I can remember as a middle school student, as an elementary school student, and even a high school student facing these challenges and not being able to talk about it because I was just too embarrassed. So I really do appreciate the school systems that are putting this on the forefront and showing the students this is okay to talk about it and that as a community we can work together to put a stop to it.
And even in Winona coming up on February 25th, Barbie, you'll be visiting Winona. You all will be sharing this movie and then talking about it afterwards. Corrine, do you want to talk about why it is that you wanted to show this movie on such a community-wide level and get that conversation started again?
Well, my mom heard Barbie speak at the ELCA Greater Milwaukee Synod Assembly, and she called me right away and said, "You've got to hear this woman. She's down to earth, and she has something to say." And so, Barbie, your voice does matter. I thank you for sharing it with me and with my mom.
Thank you.
And we're excited to bring her to Winona. I talked to Larry Labor and Pastor Jeff Franco about bringing her, and Larry's been very instrumental in getting this ball rolling. So we wanted to not only show the film and bring you, Barbie, to Winona, but then to get that conversation started afterwards. So now what are we going to do? So it's not a night of let's hear somebody speak about hunger and then go back to our normal lives. But how is this going to make a difference? And Pastor Jeff talked about this being so close to campus that we get to show the film at the Lutheran Campus Center, open to the public, and then hear Barbie speak in the evening, and we can help college students learn how to be make a difference in the world.
Because, Pastor Jeff, as you said, there are a lot of just different things going on in the Winona area to address food insecurity. But this is almost taking it a step further.
That's right. One of the things that Winona's been very good at is recognizing that there is a need. And congregations have stepped up and provided community meals 3 days a week. And we've got a terrific food shelf for the community. And so there's a lot of resources there. But it's kind of like there's a stigma. You've got one segment of our community that uses this, and the rest of the community doesn't even acknowledge it. And what we're trying to do is to widen the conversation so that we can act together to make a bigger difference.
And even cutting through that stigma and maybe just getting people to think more openly about that, what sort of difference could that make just for the entire community, for those who need assistance and those who are fortunate enough to not need assistance?
Well, I think one of the things that can happen is that so often we identify others by their station in life. And rather than seeing one group as having a problem and another group having a solution, coming together and seeing we have things in common that we can grow from each other and learn from each other and help each other.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about hunger and food insecurity and what people are doing to combat it in their community. My guests are Pastor Jeff Franco. He's retired from the Central Lutheran Church of Winona. Pastor Corrine Dennis. She's with the Lutheran Campus Ministry in Winona. And Barbie Izquierdo. She works with the organization Witness to Hunger and is a student in Philadelphia. You know, one of the ways that hunger or food insecurity is defined as often people look towards free and reduced lunches within an individual school district. Here in La Crosse, at least in the 2013-2014 school year, 49% of the students here were on free and reduced lunch. In Winona, I believe the latest statistic was about 33%. And that can have a major impact on not just a community, but, I mean, the individual student's life. Pastor Jeff, do you want to talk a bit about that?
The documentary did a terrific job of identifying how that affects the student's learning ability and be able to concentrate on studying. If you're hungry all the time, you're not going to be able to perform well in school. And so that's going to have a broader effect than just filling a stomach. It's filling a mind that's going to be able to go into the future and make some contributions to society.
And Barbie, this is something that you talked quite a bit about in the documentary. Can you maybe expand upon that and just, you know, how it has impacted your children? And I know that you may have some hesitations about making your children poster children of this, but
I question a lot, even today, if, you know, the challenges that we faced with hunger are things that are contributing to the way that my kids are, specifically my son, Aiden. In the film, you saw some of my struggles of the doctor visits that I had to take him to, and you learned about how he was diagnosed with speech delay and was in these early intervention programs. Well, now he's 7 years old, and just last April, he was diagnosed with ADHD. So as I'm trying to work through that, I have him seeing a therapist, and maybe 2 weeks ago, I found out that he is also diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder. I'm sorry, it's something that I'm still getting used to.
Sure.
Which I didn't even know existed, and it becomes difficult to think, well, was there something that I could have done to help him? Was, you know, the lack of the nutrition that he didn't receive and needed a contribution to these specific dangers that he's facing and limitations? And I don't tell my son that he has ADHD or ODD because I don't want him to feel singled out, and I don't want him to sort of limit himself and think that he's incapable of these things. But at times it is frustrating trying to find a way to work with him and understand him, and at times make him understand the things that he can and cannot do when I don't even understand them myself. And most times all I can do is sit there and try to point a finger and try to blame myself because I wasn't able to provide for him the way that I should have. But it's something new that we're trying to work through together, and some things works and some things don't work. But right now I'm just trying to steer away from any sort of medication and just try to find another method that can work for him so that I don't have to worry about more so things that can go wrong down the line. But as things are going on and more of these disorders and conditions are coming out, it's becoming a little bit more difficult to sort of pinpoint what caused it. Could I have prevented it, and what to do in the future?
But it's interesting because, I mean, I think it seems like you're putting a little pressure on yourself, but it seems very clear that you've done everything you can to really provide the best life for your children.
Thank you. You know, I think that's one of the things that keeps me going. But I've always known that I didn't belong here. And when I say here, I say in the difficult neighborhoods of Philadelphia. I've always known that I was smart and that I had potential, but I think the surroundings just always made me doubt what I was capable of. And it gave me that fear of not being able to reach beyond what was just there. And, you know, working with the people from a place at the table, and specifically with Witnesses to Hunger, it gave me the courage and the knowledge to just keep pushing forward. And, you know, I do think that my kids deserve better than what I can give them right now. But through the film and through Witnesses to Hunger, I'm just growing and learning and trying to continue to better their future and better my future so that I can show them at the end of the day that this was a difficult decision to make, and that unfortunately I did expose their lives, but that I did it for good reason. And hopefully someday they would even understand that this was bigger than them. It was bigger than myself. This was something that can possibly change society and the way society views people, statistics, and how we can sort of move away from the number and let people become people and their circumstances come out to the light so that we can work together to make a change. And if I can accomplish that, then it was all worth it.
Corrine, I'm curious, since you work with a number of college students, you know, what are they thinking about in this situation? How is it that they feel like they can help? Or, you know, I'm sure that there are a number of students that you work with who are experiencing hunger themselves.
I actually hear a lot of times that I guess I'll be eating cereal all week, and I wonder how I can help them and offer up some of the community meals in town. I think college students today especially want to change the world, and not in an idealistic Pollyanna view, but they really believe that they can make a difference in their world, so their surroundings. I think this generation is able to use the phrase think global and act local, that when they are in college and they have experiences with places such as Lutheran Campus Ministry and they get to hear other people's stories, it changes their perspective. It changes their worldview to realize they have a voice, they can make a difference, and it's not I'm going to save somebody, but it's how can we do this together?
Do you feel like many of them are putting their needs aside maybe to help the greater common good? And how do you balance that?
I think that is a huge need right now. I actually just talked with a group of people yesterday about Sabbath rest and how students are so busy and I think they do often put their needs aside for the sake of others. And then others simply focus on themselves. And so that balance is instrumental. We have conversations often at the Lutheran Campus Center in Winona about the world, about what's going on in campus. And people come to the table and say, this is what I'm struggling with. What do you think? People are able to be vulnerable and bring those questions that keep them up in the middle of the night, such as, how do I not just focus on myself? Or how do I care for myself in order to care for others?
Pastor Jeff, did you want to add to that?
I think one of the things in retirement that I've had the joy of doing is volunteering at the Lutheran Campus Ministry in Winona. And what has impressed me just comparing my generation going through college and what I see in students today is how much mature and how skilled they are and capable they are at their young age compared to where I was at their age. And the consciousness that they bring to wanting to see their lives as not just making a living and having a future for themselves, but really making a difference in the community and the world. That's really inspiring for me to see that the generation that often gets labeled as kind of lazy and just kind of self-centered is really, I think, a very noble generation that's going to be good for our future.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about food insecurity. My guests are Pastor Jeff Franco. He's retired from Central Lutheran Church of Winona. Pastor Corrine Dennis. She's with the Lutheran Campus Ministry in Winona. And Barbie Izquierdo is joining us by phone in Philadelphia. She works with the organization Witness to Hunger. I'm wondering, what do you think are some of the greatest misconceptions when it comes to food insecurity currently, either, Barbie from Philadelphia, and I don't know if those misconceptions vary from the Winona and La Crosse area, but Pastor Jeff, do you want to maybe chime in first?
Well, I think maybe one big misconception that I hear often is that those who are poor are lazy and aren't taking initiative and are using the system. And that if you make some resources available to them, they're just going to abuse it, and they're going to use it as long as they can. And I think really my experience has been that people don't like to be on assistance. They want to make a living for themselves. They want to take pride in how they raise their family, they are far from lazy and have been dealt some tough cards and are doing the best they can.
Corrine, what are some of the greatest misconceptions that you think people should overcome when it comes to hunger?
Well, I would agree with Pastor Jeff in that the people are lazy or they just don't want to work, they want to be on assistance, or that it's somebody else's problem. I often share with my daughter that when she was first born that we needed a little help with some food. And I tell her that's why we care about this. We take care of each other because it could be anybody. It's not people who are lazy or not working. It's people who are working, who have full-time jobs, who are just trying to make ends meet. And that's why we take care of each other.
And Barbie, you've really played a role in trying to fight a lot of these misconceptions.
Yes, I would definitely also agree with Pastor Jeff. I, even after people have viewed the film during question and answer sessions that I would go be a guest speaker, I would still have people questioning my motives, questioning, you know, my skills as a mother and just the person that I am. And, you know, it's hard for me to grasp that at times because I'm like, did you not just see everything that I went through? And exposing my life like that isn't easy. But I just think that once people believe something, whether they're shown different or not, it's hard to sort of get out of that mold. And I think that with more support and more people speaking up and showing that, you know, just because you are on public assistance doesn't mean that you're going to abuse the system or that someone who is significant to the community can stem from these programs. I think it'll sort of change the mindset that people have. And also, I think the media has a large say-so in this because it's easier to find something online or in newspapers about the so, quote-unquote, called welfare queen, which is the person who is abusing the system. I've read stories about people who've won the lottery and still been on public assistance. And I think people just need to look at that person for that person, who they are and what they do. Because it's sort of like saying if one person is a criminal, then everyone else in that community is a criminal as well. And I think that we sort of need to move away from that and say, yes, there are people who have abused the system. That's true. It's 100% true. But there are people who need it. There are people who are not single mothers that are just a complete family, mother and father, both working full-time jobs and still can't make ends meet. And I think that when people open their eyes and sort of stray away from those things in the media, that they'll actually see that this is real and that it's something that is solvable, because it is harder to find that news story about that person who came from welfare, who is doing great things. And just for a quick example, I remember when I went to the Hill one time to testify, I met a congresswoman who came up to me and said, you know, none of my peers here know that I was on welfare. And I looked at her and I myself thought, wow, like this is a very important person. And I never would have thought that this person is on welfare. But then I realized that that's the problem. Even with my assumption, seeing someone and being surrounded by people who are so successful, I myself was surprised to know that at one point in time in her life, she was on welfare. And I think that if we just change that, if we become blindsided to a person's past or to their income, then we will begin to take the necessary measures to move forward.
So in a minute, I want to jump into and talk about how people can really address this issue. But probably before that, we should talk about some of the root causes of food insecurity. Just to put that out there, I mean, you could say that poverty leads to it. You know, fruits and vegetables are not cheap. We have food deserts. I mean, we even have food deserts here in La Crosse. Pastor Jeff, did you want to?
One of the great things about being retired is that I do get time to volunteer now. And one of the places I also volunteer is at a meal here in La Crosse, come for supper at Our Savior's Lutheran, that every Tuesday night they serve between 200 and 300 people from the downtown area of La Crosse. And primarily most of these people that come are coming from the high-rise and low-income housing in that area. And one thing that strikes me about the people we serve there is that most of them are on assistance and need help because they've got emotional and psychological problems that have really put them in a position where they can't work and they can't provide for themselves. And so many of the resources that I've seen that we can put forth there really makes a difference for a part of the community that really is marginalized and lives in deep poverty right in our midst. And I think what happens is that most people don't even see that part of La Crosse and realize that it's there.
Pastor Corrine?
Well, I think one of the root causes is exactly what Barbie, you were just talking about, is silence. And it's easier, I think, to hold on to those images even after someone has seen this documentary, to because it makes it someone else's problem. So if we can hold on to that stereotype of the so-called welfare queen, then it's their problem rather than this is for the sake of the common good. This is our problem together as a country.
And Barbie, there's a part in the movie that one of the many parts that was quite emotional. You talk about how it takes you, I don't know if it was an hour round trip or an hour each way on the bus to even get to a grocery store to get healthy food for your family. Is that still something that you deal with in your life?
It's not something that I struggle with now. I have moved around quite a bit since the film, but I do still know that, like, at the corner store, which will be the thing that's most convenient when, you know, there's weather like this where it's really cold, you can't go and find an apple or find a banana that you can give to your kids, but you can find plenty of bags of chips. And I think that, you know, I'm glad that was shown in the film, because I think if these stores that are so convenient, that are so close to home, were able to provide these things that are more nutritious, and if they were a little bit more affordable, that it would make a big change with the problem. And one of the things that I always say when people say, well, you know, what are the things that causes this? I always say affordability and accessibility. And one without the other still doesn't really help.
Pastor Kareen, can you talk about just the roles that religious organizations can play when it comes to addressing hunger?
Well, one of the ways that religious organizations do in Winona is, as Jeff said, through these community meals. I think it was touched on in the film as well that we can't replace justice with charity. So that we can keep reaching out, we can keep providing food for our communities and for one another, but we also need to affect change in the systemic level of why is there a need for a community meal in the first place? As Barbie was talking about right before, about affordability, distribution, and accessibility.
And, I mean, is it up to churches and local nonprofits to fill in these gaps? Because it's almost like addressing it from an emergency level, in a way.
Well, and it is. And I think Jeff Bridges in the film did a great job of explaining that, yeah, we can use nonprofits to make a difference there in churches. But we wouldn't trust securing our defense with nonprofits. Mm-hmm. And he makes a good point that, yeah, you know, that I think the government and our political system needs to play a significant role in this, because it's all of our problem. It isn't just an act of charity on the part of churches and nonprofits.
Jeff Franco is a retired pastor of Central Lutheran Church in Winona. Kareen Dennis is pastor at the Lutheran Campus Center in Winona. And Barbie Izquierdo is a nationally recognized expert on hunger and poverty issues from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Izquierdo will be speaking at Central Lutheran Church in Winona on Wednesday, February 25th, as part of an event to get Winona residents inspired to fight hunger issues in the community. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, we'll talk about a new project that's bringing art and La Crosse's history together. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find a link to the February 25th hunger event in Winona. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share a comment or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Art can provide a snapshot into history. We can learn so much about our past when we study the paintings or sculptures of a particular era. But what happens when you bring history and art together now? Through a new project called Artifact, Organizers are seeking artists to create pieces inspired by local historical objects. Here today to talk about Artifact are Ariel Bougeau. She's a UW La Crosse Assistant Professor of History and co-director of Artifact. Ariel Raker is also co-director, and she's a PR manager for the project. And Callie O'Connor is the curator. And both Callie and Ariel, the second Ariel there, are UW La Crosse students. So Ariel Bougeau, I'm wondering if you can first just explain what exactly Artifact is.
What is Artifact?
What is Artifact?
It's an exhibit that will go on at the Pump House Regional Arts Center in February and March.
Of 2016. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And what it is we're choosing 15 local artifacts, so things like cigar boxes, because there was a big cigar manufacturing industry here, the Winona, the Leona. I always say that wrong. Yeah, the Leona, which is a woman's undergarment. What else do we have? We have a dress that Kelly's studying.
Yeah. We have a dress that was sold at Newberg's in La Crosse, which is actually a men's clothing store, but they had some women's clothing there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And a wedding dress designed by a woman in 1914. And actually the Leona, that's a patented undergarment that was designed by this woman, and she sold it all over the world, I believe.
But she started here in La Crosse?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, how neat.
Mm-hmm.
Just on Main Street.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
You can visit her house as an antique shop now.
Okay.
We have two patented products. The other one is a
paper fastener.
Paper fastener, that's it.
That was also developed here in La Crosse.
Yep.
It's from the Bump Pump Company, which was located in La Crosse. And it's a paper fastener that doesn't use staples, but it works as, it looks like an industrial stapler, but it just kind of puts it all together without using any metal.
Huh.
Right.
So all of these projects, or all of these objects, are things that you all found through the La Crosse Historical Society. Mm-hmm. Ariel, do you want to maybe talk about that partnership and how you all chose the different objects to include in this project?
Of course. So this project actually started as a graded class project in the Intro to Public and Policy History class taught by Dr. Ariel Bougeau in the fall of 2013. And it was a group project. My group members were Mathis Yama, who was a German foreign exchange student and is now back in Germany, and Amanda Drummond, who was graduating that semester and has since, I believe, moved on to graduate school. And Amanda had been interning at the La Crosse County Historical Society for several semesters at this point. And because the main stipulation of the assignment was to partner with a local organization and create a public history project for them. And so we figured let's capitalize on this relationship that's already been established. Peggy and Amanda knew each other very well. And so we went down to the collections and we're peeking through. And at first we're like, oh, let's do like a traveling exhibit on typewriters or like cameras, 'cause they had a lot of those. But, Peggy said, look, we have a lot of objects that were made in La Crosse. I've always wanted to do something with it. You know, how can we, let's do something with that. And then talking with Dr. Ariel Bougeau, we decided, okay, but let's make it a little bit more interesting. Let's add something to it, like try like art or something. And just through kind of talking and then talking with the Pump House Regional Arts Center, you know, what have you done before? What's worked? What's not? We really kind of all together developed this collaboration, I should say, between art and history, two local organizations, local artists, local businesses. I refer to it as the Holy Trinity.
And Callie, was it hard to narrow down each of the objects, these 15 objects?
It was really interesting. I actually researched five of them specifically last semester, and we actually found out one of them was not made in La Crosse, but it's so incredible. You just go from the little bit of information we have on them and it's like a scavenger hunt. You find one thing after another, and it was super interesting. There are some things that we have as parameters. We don't want too many textile objects. We don't want too many of a certain type of object, but our only big parameter is that it has to be made in La Crosse, and it's been really fun looking through them and researching them.
But yeah, as you said, it's textiles, it's the mm-hmm. cigar boxes, Ariel, that you mentioned before.
We're looking for some artifacts that represent our Ho-Chunk community and our Hmong community as well. So we have a third student that's working on this project, also named Callie.
Kelly.
Two Ariels and two Kellys. Yeah, yes. Perfect.
And she's a diversity coordinator and education manager. And so it's her job this semester to, and she's also interning with the Historical Society and Peggy Derrick. And she's trying to find artifacts made in La Crosse that will represent those communities as well.
Yeah, I would also like to add too, just Kelly, Nimi, and I are in a grant writing class where we're writing one of the grants for the project, and we were looking at some of the census data to try and work with needs assessment and justification. And in looking at the census data, Asian populations make up 4.9% of La Crosse. It's the second highest population, so that's definitely one of our serious goals, is to really represent the diversity that does live in La Crosse.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. Today, we're talking about Artifact, a new project that blends history and art. My guests are Ariel Raker. She's the co-director and PR manager for Artifact. Callie O'Connor is the curator, and both of them are UW-La Crosse students. And Ariel Bougeau, she's a UW-La Crosse assistant professor of history and co-director of Artifact. So you've picked out your objects. Or I guess you're still hunting for some. But essentially, right now, you have a call out to artists to interpret these artifacts in their own way. Ariel, can you explain that process and what exactly you all are looking for?
Right. So we have a website. It's art-effect.org.
And we'll have a link on our website.
Right. That's great. So on the website, what you will see is that on September 15th, there will be is the end of our call to artists. You will be asked to give an example of 5 works of art, and then there will be the blind jury that works with the pump house. They will choose the 15 artists, and really we're looking for any sort of art other than performance art. So they'll choose a diversity of artists. They will put the artifact with the artist and then allow the artists time to go. We'll give them 3 months to create a piece of art that represents the artifact in some way.
Wow. And the students get to choose which artist gets which artifact.
No, it's not the students. Okay. It will be the jurors.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so actually this part is out of our hands. It's the jurors of the pump house that will do that work. So what the students will do, so eventually what I'm going to do is teach a class on this. So starting in September until next, well, who knows? From September until
the project
May?
Ends?
May, yeah.
Okay.
I'll be teaching a class where the students will do a material culture analysis of each object.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so I'm actually a material culturalist.
Oh.
So I'll teach the students my craft, which is studying an object for what it can tell you about the history of the place that made it or the people that made it, right?
Based on the materials,
more yeah. or less? Well, it's all kinds of things.
Okay.
Things have markers on them,
mm-hmm.
So you'll be able to see the manufacturer sometimes, and then sometimes materials will tell you something, right? Rayon only comes at a certain time. The color mauve only comes at a certain mm-hmm. time, right? So there's the history of those of color. There's a history of fabric. There's a history of manufacture and how that changes over time. And then there's the company that created it that you can research. And then really my book, which is called Victorian Fashion Accessories, that looks at objects and what they can tell us about Victorian culture, right? So what can a fan tell us about flirting in Victorian Britain?
Mm-hmm.
What can gloves tell us about how women wanted to represent their hands that worked all day, but they weren't supposed to be working, right? How does that help them represent themselves as a true woman, right? So each of our artifacts will tell us something about, you know, why is a cigar box square? When you consider that cigars they're long and thin, but they're round, right? So why is it square? So often you can see from an artifact a connection to other artifacts, right? Our culture is square, right? Our culture is linear. It's not circular, right? Unlike what we might say about the Ho-Chunk Nation
right.
culture, right? And circularness is very important to that culture. So So it represents the culture. The things that we will look at will represent the culture in various ways. And I don't know which ways because my students haven't done the work yet.
Well, it's so amazing that, I mean, this is a public art project, I guess, at its core, but just the educational element that comes about from all of this. What is that like for you, Callie?
I think this exhibit is super exciting to people who don't learn history in the traditional ways. History is one of those subjects like math that only certain people can excel at, at least only certain people seem to excel at. And I think if it's taught in different ways, that's like the best way to reach other audiences. And with museum, specifically history museum exhibits, that's always a hard push, is to try to get those different audiences. And I think with the art aspect of that, that we're really solving that problem.
Ariel, did you want to add on?
Yeah, that's also something that we're really, Callie, Nimi, and I are working really hard on. One of our goals in our mission statement is also for the educational aspect of this. And one of the things we're really looking to do is hopefully get local schools as well part of this. And so we've been doing a lot of research on arts integration and how important that is. And just a few of the snippets that we found so far is that arts integration provides better retention of knowledge. So, you know, there was a study that was done that looked at, so they were teaching history, and so they interviewed the kids right before, right after, and 2 months later. Right before, they were all at the same level. Right after, they were all at the same level. But 2 months on, the kids who'd gone through the arts integration curriculum remembered so much more than the kids who had not. So really, kind of one of the bigger goals of this project to include the students is to provide them opportunities to learn history in a different way, especially local history. It's important to know where you're from and to know why the place you're from is the way it is. And that can really be important to provide, to be a better citizen, to be a better just member of society. So providing opportunities like that to hopefully increase interest as well is really what we're trying to do.
It is interesting how this can really teach so many more people just about our local history. Like, I had no idea that a certain type of pin was invented in La Crosse, however long ago it was. And, you know, so just with one exhibit, you could learn so much and how that just spills over into what else was going on in La Crosse at that point in time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ariel?
Oh, the other thing I'd like to add to is the other thing that I love about our project is that it, you know, you can go through as just an art person and enjoy the art, or you can go through it just as a history person and enjoy it. So I don't think you have to be just a history or just an art. I think anybody can go through and really glean something from it as well.
So when it comes to once the artists are selected and they're assigned a specific artifact, I'm assuming it's up to them to do what they want with the work of art.
So what we do is we, as students, we'll compile a complete portfolio of all the research done on the artifact, the historical research, the material culture analysis, and then that will be given to the artists, and they use that as their inspiration as much as the actual visual look of the artifact.
So they won't be incorporating the artifact into the work of art. I'm sure that could be dangerous.
No, because it's a museum piece. Sure. If it wasn't, then they could, for sure. But because we've joined up with the Historical Society, we can't have them integrating that particular piece, but they might find another one at the many, many antique places around La Crosse.
Good point. So, I mean, I'm sure you've all had different ideas floating in your heads as to ways that artists could interpret this. Ariel, have you had any of your own ideas?
Yeah, so one of the original ideas that Amanda and Mathis and I had that we included in our first presentation was taking either the wedding dress or the Leona and pairing it with maybe like a metalwork specialist. We found an artist who actually had done this incredible piece. It was very obviously like a dress, but it was made of all metal, and it was very modern. It was very raw. It was so cool. Just so cool. And so I really like the idea of kind of mixing mediums. So not putting a textile specialist with another, or textile with a textile specialist, but, you know, maybe putting a textile with someone who deals in ceramics, or, you know, doing fun, interesting things that really could really play with like the textures of things.
Callie?
I read an article not too long ago about, I think it was actually a university, an art department who created paper 18th century French gowns, like these massive gowns, wow, just completely out of paper. And I thought that was the most interesting thing I'd ever seen.
So a paper artist with the wedding gown.
Yeah.
All right, check. Well,
we're looking for a paper artist.
Yeah.
Ariel, do you have a bookbinder, please?
Yeah, right. Have you had ideas?
Have I had ideas?
Or have you left that up to the students?
The piece that Ariel was speaking about, mm-hmm, that metal piece, that was on the cover of a friend of mine's book. That artist, a piece of hers, it was a brassiere. Do you remember that? It was a gold brassiere. And that was a book about lingerie. Okay. So there's a woman who I really like who works in oil with oil barrels, and she'll carve things out of oil barrels. So originally, when Ariel and I had originally, and her group, right, had originally spoken about, like, how can we make this really interesting? How can we make this go? Before I even got here, I started developing a class on 10 Objects That Changed the World. Mm-hmm. And I had an idea to do a similar thing at the Pump House, where we would have the podcast that the students have been creating over time on this project, and then have artists respond. So those oil barrels, that oil barrel art was really interesting to me, because oil is one of the objects that changed the world, mm-hmm, right? And so that's kind of where I was thinking, and that doesn't really relate to what we're doing. Although there is some history of oil here. So now I'm thinking.
No, that's okay.
As it goes.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, I mean, there are endless possibilities, mm-hmm, obviously, with art, and just it must be so interesting, the ideas that will be coming out of this.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I'm really looking forward to as the PR manager. I've already got ourselves an Instagram account and Twitter, obviously, and Facebook. But I'm really excited about the Instagram opportunities. One of the things I'm hoping to do, and it's something that we're going to obviously have to coordinate with the artist, is to actually travel to their studios while they're creating, mm-hmm, and take kind of sneak peeks and show, you know, be able to kind of visit with them and see, okay, so you got the wedding dress. What are you doing? You know, like, what are you thinking? What's your process? So I really want to also kind of incorporate some of that into it as well.
Is it important to involve the public in that behind the scenes process when it comes to something like this? I mean, does it get people engaged or excited about it a little more?
Well, Ariel? We like to do that, of course.
Yeah.
The three of us are also involved in the Hear Hear project.
Sure.
So we're always interested in incorporating the public into the work that we're doing. Not only as, like, we're doing history for the public, we're doing history with the public in this case, right? And in all the cases, we try and do that more and more. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we're thinking about for the education to, again, involve the public. So we'll have the students and the artists presenting together, you know, maybe three student-artist combinations at a time at the Pump House, where they will give kind of an artist history talk together, you know, and the public can come to that and ask questions and so on. But there's the public, which is the students, and then there's the public that's the art. And mm-hmm. then there's the public that can be the audience, but the audience, I think more and more, especially with Hear Hear, but we'll think about how to integrate this stuff into Artifact as well. How can the audience become move from the public and become someone who's interacting and representing the project or recreating the project again. So mm-hmm. I don't know. We haven't really thought through how we could do that for this.
Yeah. Kelly, Nimi, and I have had a couple ideas with the education aspect, because we want to include local students. We're kind of thinking, like, part of the curriculum we'll develop is, like, you know, we don't want to have to develop a curriculum for every single age group, but we're thinking, you know, do a couple kind of steps, and then within that have assignments that they could, that'll be much more age appropriate. So, like, maybe with third graders, they'll come through and we'll have them go home and find, you know, look at an old piano, and they get to do an art project with it. Or, you know, an eighth grader might have to invest, you know, do like a book report or something like that. So I'm wondering if maybe we could almost do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Is there anything else that the three of you would like to talk about, Ariel?
I guess just especially because right now we're looking for call to artists, please, if you're somewhat interested, the submission fee is only $15, which is extremely reasonable. That's one of the reasons why we did that is we want students, we want anybody to be able to apply to be in it. We're looking for all different types of mediums except performance art. But seriously, all different types of mediums. We are as interested in all the crazy, wacky, cool things that you can do. And we fully believe that you can do stuff with the artifacts that we'll give you.
Ariel Bougeot is a UW-La Crosse Assistant Professor of History and Co-Director of Artifact. Ariel Raker is Co-Director and PR Manager. And Callie O'Connor is Curator. Both Ariel Raker and Callie O'Connor are also UW-La Crosse students. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. You can find a link to Artifact's website at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has links to this show and other recent editions of Newsmakers. And if you'd like to share your comments and or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.